The second annual Not Valentine's Itty Bitty Podfic Anthology, a collection of 18 short podfics from 15 fandoms, read by Fire Juggler. A Heartbeat by Bright Wolf. Fandom Star Trek 2009, pairing Kirk Spock. A Heartbeat. Such a complex thing, if you stop to consider it. Most people, he is aware, do not. They know it exists and leave it at that. The intricacies of biology and all it entails escape them, and they are content. Intellectually, he knows that the organ is vital for the existence of any living being, that it is the strongest muscle, and accomplishes its purpose of circulating blood cells that carry necessary nutrients and oxygen through the arteries and veins in the cell's endless cycle through the body. In the detached clinical processes of his mind, the heart is nothing more, nothing less. Those are the observations he is supposed to make, those that are acceptable to him and his people and have been for countless eons. And yet, knowing the purpose behind the blood flowing through a form does not detract from the wonder he feels when he glimpses the process at work, or, to put it more accurately, when he is reminded how its intricacies are evinced in one specific being. He refuses to dwell on this revelation, instead attempting to keep the clinical processes, bolstering his defenses with logic. And yet, for instance, there is this vein, located mid-temple, which pulses almost imperceptibly when that person experiences anger, such as was happening then when his captain was being confronted by a genocidal maniac who was threatening their people. He could hear the teeth grinding in that jaw, and yet there was no outward sign that his captain was not in complete control of himself and the situation, except that single solitary vein pulsing as it fed the rage, faster than normal, as an adrenaline spike flowed through the conduits, accelerating cerebral function and allowing his captain to outmaneuver their adversary and save the day. Again. And yet, a head turned to the side, laughing at a comment someone else has made, exposing soft flesh to any who cared to allow their attention to linger there. He most certainly did not, but could not pull his eyes away from the sight of skin laid bare. The single vein, standing out in stark relief as the muscles were stretched, a slow beat, much slower than his own heartbeat, which had inexplicably sped up at his observation. It was almost lazy, the pace it set, perfectly representing the coiled lion strength and intellect of the man to which it is an essential function. And yet, a fluttering against his skin, as his hand was grasped in another. He can hear the pulse point on the thumb as it was pressed indelibly into his flesh, a loud klaxon that silenced any other sensation as he was treated with a blinding smile. As soon as his captain was placed back on his feet, his hand was released. He had felt oddly bereft at the loss of that feather beat against his skin. But his captain was calling him back to duty, and he had no desire but to follow. And yet, a tentative touch of lips against his, as through the contact he felt the rush of blood speeding on its journey, making the lips full, enhancing sensation, and clearly signifying arousal. He could feel the pulse points in his fingertips, as one hand wrapped around his captain's neck, a thumb brushing just under his hem, whispering promises to the skin that begged for touch. He was quietly amazed at his captain's daring as he deepened the kiss, his other hand reaching up to tentatively caress that temple, at the vein that is an intricate part of everything he holds dear. Intellectually, he understands. This heart, the beat that sings to him as his captain sleeps against him, exists for one simple purpose. That the constant pounding flow of blood he believes he can feel through every inch of skin laid against his is not intended as a reminder that his captain is alive and his. Knowing, and the wonder that comes at recognizing the beauty of existence when encapsulated in one single man, he has found that these twain are not separate, but irrevocably entwined. The end. Clean Slate by Alchemy Alice. Fandom Skyfall. This fic contains content notes for canonical character death and spoilers. He shakes Mallory's hand and he feels purged. It's a strange sort of cleanliness, and if Bond were given to self-reflection, which he never has been and never will be now, he would think it may be unhealthy, or maybe hollow. And he does feel hollow. There's a blank space somewhere in his sternum that when he breathes, it whistles like a gale through a broken window. But it doesn't hurt, precisely. It just exists. He needs this, he thinks. If he is to continue, he will need it this way. Kincaid has walked with him to the entrance of Skyfall, the both of them rickety now, Bond limping and shivering beneath Kincaid's hunting jacket. "Won't be seeing you again, will I?" Kincaid asked, as headlights from a company car appear in the distance. "No, I imagine not," Bond answers. "Will you be all right?" "Have been, haven't I?" he retorted. Bond snorted. The flames around the house began to die, could only do so much with the iron and stone once they'd eaten through the mothballs and mahogany. Bond still felt them burning in his chest, though, like a phoenix stealing his breath from the inside out, stretching its wings within the cage of his ribs. "Sorry about the house," he said absently. "It was ready," Kincaid shrugged. Bond has a feeling that Kincaid is almost ready, too. He shakes hands with him when he goes, and doesn't look back. Bond feels ready, too, standing in Mal in M's office. He feels stripped down to his bare essentials, and even if his file remains full, it sits light on his shoulders now. Everyone who has known what lies beyond its censor bars, known him beyond words on a page, have now become words themselves. He will carry those words, but they will be tucked away, deep in that hollow space, where the light won't reach, where a flare would sputter and die before it ever broke the surface. Now he is a vase, poured out, scrubbed with iron wool. He is black courier print on white paper, black tuxedo over white French cuffs, and his blood is more vodka than plasma, chilly with the ice shards it was shaken with. He has known fear, every facet. He won't any longer. The end. Sweat by Kathleen. Fandom Stargate Atlantis. Pairing Rodney McKay, John Shepherd. Rodney watches another drop of sweat roll, slow as honey, down Shepherd's forehead towards his temple. It hangs, delicately, in a strand of hair plastered to his face by the hard work of the day, falls to roll over a cheekbone, then drops, quick and light, to his chest, golden and bare in the Athosian summer sun. Rodney watches, fascinated, the ache of want temporarily canceling out the instinct towards caution, as it slides down the skin peppered with curly hair. Silk and wire to the touch, he imagines, as the same drop traces a path, almost delicately, over abs defined by sharp muscle and lithe strength. As if to draw out his torture or prolong his pleasure, the drop of sweat slows as it nears the loose waist of Shepherd's pants, defying gravity just like Rodney's own heart, flipping randomly at odd moments. And then it slithers, soft as his own fingers would be, down and down, until suddenly it's gone, absorbed into the sweat-soaked waistline of the BDUs which cling, barely, to Shepherd's hips. The spell breaks, and he feels himself flush, looking up swiftly under his eyelashes to make sure Shepherd hasn't seen, But his heart stops because Shepherd, John, is looking at him, watching him, with a look on his face, a look Rodney can't decipher. Everything is still, silent for a beat of time, and Rodney's heart twists because he's blown it for good and forever now, and nothing will ever be the same. Except then Shepherd, half-naked, dark, sweat-soaked hair making his eyes electric, steps close to Rodney, and then closer still. Rodney can't breathe, seriously, has no air left in his body. And then he thinks maybe he's hallucinating the whole thing from oxygen deprivation, because John reaches out a tanned, muscled arm, lifts a hand to Rodney's brow, and brushes his burning fingers over Rodney's forehead. Once, twice, three heart-stoppingly slow times, wiping the gathered sweat away, and then lets his hand fall. "Sweat's gonna get in your eyes," he says. Rodney gapes a minute, but he's not a genius for nothing, so he lets his shaking hand lift towards John's face, where another drop of sweat is hovering, this time sliding down his cheek, heading towards his mouth, or close enough. John lifts his eyebrow at Rodney, and is that a dare? Because no problem, he's in. So he rests his hand feather light on John's cheek and lets his thumb brush once, silky, over John's upper lip, swiping away the bead threatening to slither into John's mouth. "Hot day," Rodney manages to rasp, forcing himself to step back, reclaim the necessary distance, pulse stuttering wildly. They don't touch again the rest of that day. Rodney would almost think that he daydreamed the whole thing, coming back to the sleeping starlit city late that night, body aching from hard work and long deprivation. He really has himself almost convinced it was some fever dream brought on by heat and John's bare chest, and has himself definitely convinced that if they did have a moment of mutual madness, it would be better for everyone to chalk it up to the Athosian heat wave. And maybe that would even be true. Then John, leaning against the side of the transporter after the two of them get in, says, "Hot day." "Yeah," Rodney manages, cutting a quick glance to the still open doors, then a longer glance at John. His clothes are clinging to his body where he sweated through them, his hair a little flattened for once, hanging in moisture-glued clumps around his dirt-streaked face. Rodney can smell him from his side of the transporter, redolent of earth and hard work and something else, something male, that's kicking Rodney's heart rate up, making his hands clench into fists against his want. When Rodney finally raises his eyes to John's face, there's a smirk there. But John's eyes are fixed firmly on Rodney's mouth. Rodney decides, fuck it. The doors snick shut just in time. The end. Arising by Night Reveals. Fandom Inception. Pairing Arthur Eames. The click of the door behind him is the only warning Arthur gives. Through the wide window, the city stands in relief, the sun disappearing behind countless skyscrapers. Wisps of far-off clouds mute the lingering rays, but streaks of red and yellow still blaze across the sky, glinting off burnished glass and harsh steel. Watching it all is Eames, sat on the futon facing the window, nothing of note around him. When Arthur circles a hand around Eames's from behind, Eames doesn't move. "Hello," says Eames, voice rough. "Hey yourself." Arthur can't help the grin that comes from inside him. It's not reflected on Eames's face, but that's not unusual. Arthur swings the bottle of champagne into Eames's vision. "Brought something to drink." "Wonderful," Eames says, tone measured. "I'll get us set up." It takes a few minutes for Arthur to grab two flutes from the kitchen and pour the champagne into them, taking advantage of the moment to tow off his shoes and roll up his shirt cuffs. He returns to the sprawling living room to the same sight as before. Eames, sitting on the futon in a t-shirt and thready socks, his face turned towards the sunset. Arthur swallows. So? He hands one of the flutes to Eames, taking a seat beside him. Not close enough to touch, but close enough to feel Eames's heat on his thigh. I wanted to say, the champagne is pink, interrupts Eames, not looking at Arthur, but instead at the bubbles fizzing to the top of the champagne. Yes, I had it tinged with the blood of your enemies, replies Arthur, edging his words with sarcasm. Sounds terribly unhygienic. Eames swirls the flute, watching the liquid almost tip out, still pretending to be unaware of Arthur's gaze. Sunsets have always been kind to Eames, bringing out the best in his face, if not the best in him. Arthur fists his unoccupied hand on his thigh. The small bandages on it pull tight on his aching skin. I wanted to say thank you. Eames snorts into the mouth of his flute of champagne, then takes a small sip, despite the fact that they haven't toasted. Whatever for? He asks. Don't play dumb. Arthur tightens his grip on the glass stem of the flute as harshly as he dares. You saved my life. If you hadn't come in when you did, they would have flayed... Shut it, Eames says, staring doggedly ahead, where the vestiges of the sun simmer in the sky. You shut your mouth. Arthur finishes his champagne in a gulp and puts the glass on the hardwood floor, his hand steady, even in the face of Eames's impassive mien. You saved my life, Arthur repeats. In response, Eames blinks lazily. He hasn't looked once at Arthur this whole time. Wordlessly, Arthur rises. He takes his socks off, letting them fall where they may. The floor is a shock of cold under his bare feet as he pads to the center of the room. It puts him straight in the line of Eames's vision, the wide wall of glass at Arthur's back. For the first time, Eames looks to the side, where Arthur was just a moment ago. The futon dimples under Eames when he shifts, the only sign of discomfort that Arthur notes. Arthur's shadow covers Eames, and as Arthur undoes the buttons on his shirt, his shadow mimics him, the lines of light and dark reflecting on Eames. Arthur's gray dress shirt drops to the floor, its cufflinks dragging it down heavily. There are vivid splashes of pink on Arthur's chest, skin puckered around them. Red gashes gone blue with bruising at the edges creep across Arthur's sides, the sliced skin a sign of messy knife work. Arthur moves his hands to his belt, letting it drop to the ground as well. At the heavy clink, Eames drains his champagne with his eyes closed. Done, he finally stares ahead at Arthur. For a moment, it looks like he might speak, and Arthur feels his mouth go dry. Eames says nothing. Some of his brief confidence leaves Arthur then, his shoulders sagging as the night at last comes out in full at his back. The skyscrapers block the rising moon from view, and there is no starlight here to reflect off the glass and steel of the city. With a last burst of life, Arthur walks straight to Eames, standing in front of him in slacks and nothing else. Eames keeps his eyes on his own lap, playing with an old, battered poker chip in one hand. Arthur puts a hand over the movement, stilling Eames's nervous tick. He climbs onto Eames's lap slowly, giving Eames a chance to pull away. Eames stays where he is. Thank you, says Arthur, his breath curling over Eames's ear. Eames nods against Arthur's neck, wrapping his arms around Arthur's torso and squeezing. Behind them, unseen, the moon rises to the sky. The end. Double-Edged by Astolat. Fandom, Harry Potter. Character, Neville Longbottom. Neville didn't know what to do with the sword. He'd known somehow to reach into the hat and pull it out, and somehow he'd known how to swing it, with the rubies like a fistful of pebbles in his sweaty grip, helping him keep hold. He'd known what to do in all the fighting, against the trolls, the Dementors, the Death Eaters. But now all of that was over, and the fires had been put out, and the sword was still here. He'd tried to shove it back in the sorting hat, but it wouldn't go. Harry had stared at him and said, "No!" in an almost savage way when Neville offered it to him. And he couldn't just leave it lying on the ground. So for the moment, he was carrying it around with him. Luna had wandered over to him earlier that afternoon and given him a scabbard for it and a belt, although he felt a right prat, wandering around with the thing slung at his waist like something out of King Arthur. It dragged at his shoulder and hip, so he had to walk straighter, work to keep his shoulders level. He was starting to get used to it. The End. Tie-In by Crystal Ice Kitsu. Fandom Suits. Pairing Mike Ross, Harvey Specter. "What the hell is that?" Mike looked down, twisting so he could see his backside in the closet's full-length mirror. Of course Harvey has a walk-in closet with a full-length mirror. "No, no, this." Harvey tugs on the yellow paisley tie Mike had just finished knotting. "This? This was a present." "A present," Harvey repeats. "A present. It's hideous. No, you are not wearing this. Never, never wear this tie in my presence again. I should have this burned," he continues, undoing the Windsor in harsh jerks. "According to Harvey's rules of clothing etiquette." Mike knows schmarm is dangerous with Harvey. He tends to find it arousing, and, yep, there's the look. "Harvey's rules of clothing etiquette? You think you're pretty smart, don't you?" Mike grins. "Hey, I wasn't the one who hired a college dropout as a lawyer." Harvey lets loose a sound which might normally be considered a growl and hauls him in by the ends of the tie. The kiss is lewd, dirty, filthy, completely inappropriate, full of tongue and teeth and filthy moans. Harvey pulls back with one last lick over Mike's bottom lip and grins when he gets a whimper. Mike's legs go out from under him at this point, but that's fine. Harvey's already got him pinned against a set of drawers and moaning by then. The End. Cooking for One by Hardboiled Baby. Fandom Nero Wolfe. Pairing Archie Goodwin, Nero Wolfe. Character Fritz Brenner. The knife seemed to move efficiently of its own accord, mincing the leeks and chervil with quick, crisp strokes. It was fortunate for him that his hands knew what to do, as his mind was decidedly somewhere other than on the sauce. He was not afraid or anxious. He did not consider such to be a part of his nature, no matter what Archie might blithely assume. He was concerned. Yes, that was the word. After all, it would be quite natural to be concerned when something threatened the proper balance of the household. He had heard the raised voices when the office door opened. The words were unclear, but there was no mistaking the biting, bitter tone in the final exchange, nor the decisive slamming of the front door. It was only natural to be concerned when they battled like this, not over a case or a client, but against themselves, against each other. He knew that in such a struggle there would never be a winner, only an uneasy truce, détente at best. Mutual victory could be achieved, but only if they both saw the truth for what it was, accepted it, and bowed to the inevitable. "Bow." He shook his head and sighed. The buzzer signaling for beer interrupted his abstraction. He collected himself and prepared a tray. When he entered the office, Wolf was holding an open book, but he was glaring in the direction of the unoccupied desk. As he set down the tray, Wolf said, "He thinks he is quitting again. Phooey! He will be back, Fritz." Fritz nodded. He hoped so. All the orchids in all the world would not be enough if Archie did not come back. He left the great man alone with his beer and his thoughts and returned to the kitchen. The end. Gone and a Cloud in My Heart by Book Addict 43. Fandom Hawaii 5-0. Pairing Steve McGarrett, Danny Williams. Danny's eyes slam shut as your hand slides over his cock and you can't help kissing him. His lips are as irresistible as the rest of his body, and you taste and taste as much as you can. You need to savor this and imprint it on your memory, because you know he's not here for good. He'll leave if Gracie needs him, and you would never stop him. Never. Danny's commitment to Grace, to his family, is one of the many things you love about him. You can't deny it hits all your buttons, and it's why you won't beg him to stay when the time comes. So you carefully lock away every memory of him, and keep kissing and kissing, tasting and inhaling against the time your life is empty again. The end. Marie Kessler and the Firebird by Eris Mirquoni. Fandom Grimm. This fic contains content notes of minor character death and pre-series. Marie leaned against her shovel and frowned down at the fox. "Now," she said. "Bitch," he said back at her. She raised her eyebrows and shrugged. "You lead travelers into swamps with promises of magical wildlife," she said, "and then smother them. What was this last one? Golden bird? Magic snake?" The fox opened his mouth, then sighed and looked away. "Emerald salamander," he said. "You'd be amazed at how many people fall for that one." "I'm amazed every day," Marie said. The fox looked like a man now, and she'd buried him up to his neck in the slurry-like mud of the swamp. He narrowed his eyes at her. "So that's it?" he asked. "You're just going to kill me." "That's my job," Marie said. She put down her shovel and pulled her silver knife from its sheath. "You Grimms," the fox said as she knelt down. "You think you're so righteous. I do you people a favor. The people who follow me, the thieves and the greedy, larcenous bastards who are willing to go any mile for a little more treasure. I'm culling the herd of the noxious and the cruel and the evil. You should thank me." Marie narrowed her eyes. "The cruel and the evil," she said. "You can try your silver tongue on me all you want, but you attack the naive and the young, not anyone worth killing. Talk all you want, but you're just a predator." "And you're a murderer," he snarled. Marie smiled and readied her knife. "I'm a Grimm," she said, "and we both know what that means." The fox's blood was startlingly red on the cold ground. Marie cleaned it off her knife with her handkerchief before she sheathed it. The end. New Directions by Wowbright. Fandom Glee. Pairing Kurt Blaine. The closer Kurt and Blaine get when they're alone, the further apart they sit in Glee Club. Because, seriously, if they allowed their chairs to get closer than 3 feet apart, it would be a hopeless cause. One of them would drop a hand into the space between them, and the other would catch it, and they'd sit there, hands swinging happily in the space between them. It would be fine for a moment, comfortable and reassuring and thrilling only in that they were doing it in front of other people, and that was so rare here at McKinley, outside of this room. But then Blaine would probably start dragging his thumb along the back of Kurt's hand, or Kurt would slide his fingers up to trace the tendons in Blaine's wrist, and the sense memories would flood them. Kurt would remember Blaine's mouth on his palm, his wrist, his forearm, the thin skin on the inside of his elbow. And Blaine would remember the way Kurt sighed with satisfaction when the edges of their hips touched. And they wouldn't be in the choir room anymore. All the world but skin and body and scent would disappear. So they make sure not to sit that close. Not for now, at least. Not until they're more used to this. Though Kurt's not sure he ever wants to get used to it. He has a hard time imagining not feeling breathless every time he glimpses Blaine after any length of absence, 14 hours or 14 minutes. It's all the same. He loves the insane giddiness of it, even if he has trouble concentrating in class sometimes, because the slightest thing, or nothing really, will send him off into another world, and all he can see is Blaine's flushed face, eyes wide with anticipation, lips trembling and wanting and murmuring, "Oh God, Kurt." So he keeps his chair far from Blaine's, far enough so he doesn't, you know, accidentally crawl into Blaine's lap and dry hump him in front of all the new directions. The nude erections. Yep, there's a certain nude erection he'd like to see right now. Fuck. Kurt really needs to get his mind out of the gutter. But the thing is, where his mind is right now, it doesn't feel like the gutter at all. It feels like something transcendent. He lets his mind stay there for a second, because Mr. Shu is listening to himself talk right now and won't let any of the new directions, nude erections, get a word in edgewise, and Kurt figures he's got at least 2 minutes before Mr. Shu gets to the point. So he lets that picture of Blaine's nude erection, well, all of Blaine, really, because he can't seem to see part of Blaine right now without needing to see him all, stay in his mind. He sees the trail of dark hair beneath Blaine's perfect hollow of a belly button, the line of his hip bone, the grace of his thighs. He thinks of the musky black currant taste of Blaine in his mouth, the mineral earth tang of his sweat, the honeyed salt of his tears. He glances surreptitiously at Blaine, guiltily hopes that Blaine will look back and know what Kurt is thinking and become flummoxed and moonstruck, both. But Blaine is dutifully looking at Mr. Shu, and very possibly listening to what he's saying, and fucking hell if Blaine's earnestness isn't as much of a turn-on as his earlobes and his neck and the way his sweater fits closely over his perfect broad chest. Before Friday night, when Kurt would lean his face against that chest, he thought of it as like the ground, solid and stable. But on Friday night, Kurt was reminded that ground sometimes shifts and trembles and quakes, and though that can be terrifying, it's breathtaking, too. The end. Point Work by Green. Fandom, Star Trek 2009. Pairing, Kirk Sulu. There are three things at which Sulu was tremendously apt: flying, fencing, and fucking. He didn't think of them as the three Fs or anything like that. He didn't really think of them at all. He just did them. He was a natural. Flying was an art, just like fencing. He could maneuver a ship through treacherous space as easily as slicing through a target. It was all a matter of lunges, flicks, and feints. And, although not a sport, fucking had an artistry all its own. There was the beginning footwork, as two people got to know each other, a dance of sorts that led straight to the mat, or the bed, if one was handy. Most people did not think of fucking in terms of opponents and point work. But Sulu liked the control it gave him. His partners never minded. Kirk liked it when Sulu lunged forward, pinning him to the mattress. Sulu used his tongue as a foil, stabbing Kirk's mouth and nipples wetly. He navigated Kirk's body as smoothly as he flew. Fucking Kirk was a dance of control and excitement. Kirk said, "Harder." And Sulu teased him. Kirk said, "Slow." And Sulu thrust faster. Kirk gritted out, "Bastard." And Sulu just grinned. Right now, Kirk was pressed down with his knees to his chest, panting hard and swearing harder. "Fuck! Fuck! Come on! Fuck me!" he said, and Sulu thrust deep and hard inside him. Their groans rose up, getting louder as they both got closer to coming. Kirk was still saying, "Fuck me," in a mindless way, like a mantra. And Sulu reached around and took hold of his cock, stripping it fast and hard, and Kirk finally came, clenching around Sulu's cock. Fucking into Kirk was like making the winning point, and coming felt like a triumph. The end. Quick Kiss Goodbye by Dancing Butterfly. Fandom Avengers. Pairing Clint Coulson. This fic contains content notes for major character death, grief, mourning, regret, memories, and kissing. Their last kiss was practically nothing. It was barely there, ephemeral for a moment that was the very end. It was a small, simple period in the novel of loving gestures that filled their relationship. How quick and small it was is what makes Clint so fucking angry. Well, no, that's not true. Since Loki murdered Phil, everything makes Clint angry. He functions in a state of quiet enragement 24 hours a day. He doesn't know how else to be anymore. Hell, he's been hanging around Banner's heels like a needy puppy because he hopes that somehow some of that anger management prowess will seep into him by diffusion. When he looks back on that day, not the last day Phil was alive, when he was strung out on Asgardian mindfuckery, but their last day together, he is so fucking angry that last kiss was short, rushed. There was no way he could have known or done anything different, but it makes him furious anyway. He had to get back to his duty, watching over Selvik and the Tesseract for another night shift. Phil was heading in the other direction, coming in from a long day on duty. On their last day, Clint met Phil for a few moments in the middle, which was pretty standard for them, better than passing like ships in the night, but not as good as being in sync. Over the years, they had made that a life. Clint remembers the way they ate together in their small kitchen with every new meal he sits through. He wasn't much of a cook, but he'd scrabbled together some Kraft mac and cheese from the box on the stove before Phil wandered in. They ate it together, out of the pot, leaning against the counter with chopsticks because neither of them had done dishes in 2 weeks, and those were the only clean utensils in the drawers. Phil held up his overly yellow macaroni at eye level and said, "Just like Marco Polo used to do it." Clint responded with an eloquent poke directly to the side. Phil laughed and jerked, but didn't move away. They finished in companionable silence, like they had 1,000 evenings before. Clint threw his chopsticks in the trash and sighed. "I'll probably see you on base. Throw this in the fridge before you sack out." Phil snorted. "Well, since you ask so nicely." "Hey, I just wanted to see you before I left, but I'm already late. I've got to go before Fury does the rounds." He'd moved towards the door, but Phil caught him around the waist. He could break the hold easily. Phil was a Green Beret a lifetime ago, but Clint is an active field agent. Yet he stopped. He went still, like he always did, inside and out, when Phil was holding him. Phil slid his hand around the back of his neck and squeezed. Clint leans forward and presses his mouth to Phil. His mouth opened, and he tasted like American cheese, tap water, the wood of the chopsticks, and Phil. He slipped his tongue between Phil's thin lips because he couldn't stay out when Phil let him in. Clint loved the way he answered back, his hand squeezing his nape, pulling him closer, tongue dragging across the roof of his mouth. Then, like always, when they had to go their separate ways, they broke apart before it got too much. Phil smiled at him, though, a wide one. It was one from his self-satisfied set that told Clint that he'd be jerking off to that kiss when Clint walked out that door. "Have a good day, Agent." Phil smirked and actually grabbed his ass as he walked out the door. Clint is angry at so much now that Phil is gone. There should have been more to that day. He should have said screw work, lifted Phil onto the kitchen counter and blown him. He should have called in sick and not gone in at all. He should have told Phil he loved him before he left the apartment. When he thinks of that last kiss, that very last meeting of lips on lips, Clint wishes they had taken more time. The end. Theme by Elmira Emily. Fandom Sherlock. I had been living in Baker Street for about 3 weeks. The violin, a fine old instrument of Italian provenance, had been laying around our sitting room all that time, first here, then there. But I had never seen Sherlock's hands on it, other than to generate squawks and squeals as a repellent against his brother Mycroft. Whenever my eyes were drawn by its russet glow, I remembered his question the day we met. Had he given me the chance, I would have told him that I do not object to the violin when it is played well. I wondered when I would have the opportunity to judge whether his skill was up to my taste. One late afternoon, I was upstairs in my room, snatching a few hours' sleep between coming in from the surgery and going out to what Sherlock swore would be a quick search through the archives of a defunct newspaper. "I need your eyes, John. You must come with me." I dreamt I was walking through a little park in the town where I grew up. The place was bombed to smithereens, but I walked along without fear or pity, skirting bits of debris and the falling obelisk of the war memorial. There was a melody coming from the ruins of the gazebo. Instead of a band, there was just one man, with his back to me. He was playing a violin. It struck me that the tune was familiar, but as I tried to think what it was, the dream slipped away, and I awoke. The music continued, though. I lay still, holding my breath, listening. The quality of the sound it made me sure it was Sherlock, though it was no violin piece I had ever heard before. I still couldn't lay my finger on the tune, enfolded as it was in percussive bowing and mad swooping harmonies. His skill was beyond doubt. In this, as in all he did well, he exhibited confidence bordering on arrogance. One variation spun into another. Sometimes the theme was utterly obscured, only to roar back in phrases flung like punches. I was caught up in anticipation of what would happen next. How would he further bend the music to his will? What fresh twist would he wring from the instrument? Did he move with the sound, those black curls flying, or was he as disciplined in his technique as he was in his intellect? I pulled on my trousers and a shirt and crept down the stairs. Sherlock stood facing the windows, his feet planted well apart, his head thrown back. His body swayed. He bent with an arpeggio, leaned back into a sostenuto. There was a space, not empty, but filled, with scales that changed the key. They gave him room for thought, it seemed, and his arms relaxed until the violin was nearly at his waist as he played. Then he brought the instrument back up and barreled once again into the main theme of the piece, his head jerking in sympathy with the notes. This time, among the ornament, I could follow the tune. I couldn't believe I hadn't recognized it. Before I could voice my surprise, though, he was off again, drawing the notes out with his whole body, pulling dissonance from harmony, finding possibilities and fresh leads as he went. At last, the momentum of one particular run turned him toward me. He gave me a little smile and kept playing, but the wild, impetuous quality of it was gone in favor of performing for his audience of one. After a few more bars, he brought the music to a close. "That was amazing."
"You always say that?"
"Only when it's true. You really do play very well indeed, at least when Mycroft isn't here."
Sherlock shrugged. "It's a thing I can do that he can't. Doing it badly, when he knows I can do it well."
I suppressed the urge to say, "Oh, grow up," in favor of asking him, "How long have you been working on that piece?" He looked puzzled.
"Working on it. Oh, I see. You could say that I'm always working on it. It's in the back of my head all the time, spinning around."
"Why that? Why not For Elise or something familiar?"
"Oh, come on, John. What could be more familiar? It's Big Ben, after all."
The end. Relaxation by Specky Geek Girl. Fandom Fringe. Character Astrid Farnsworth. There are only a few surefire ways for Astrid to relax these days. Now that she knows about the pattern, about the terrifying, unreal things that happen unexpectedly, about the catastrophes that she's hip-deep in cleaning up these days, well, that's enough to leave a less stable woman losing her mind. Luckily, Astrid is a very stable personality, and a very flexible one. She learns and adapts and does not break. She does, however, get very, very tired sometimes. Tired and stressed out. And on the days when she comes home feeling like she can't possibly rest with the weight of what she knows bearing down heavy on her shoulders, she draws herself a bath and makes the conscious decision to let go of all the worries and just stop thinking for an hour or two. Astrid never took this many baths before she started working in the Fringe division. Now she takes 2 a week, at least, often more. She fills the tub with bubbles, sets candles on the floor and on the top of the toilet and the ledge of the tub, and submerges herself into a warm, sweetly scented, gently flickering world of calm. Even though she's scrupulously clean when working in the lab, it helps to think of soaking away the ichor and mess of whatever investigation she's been up to her elbows in that day. She does nothing more complicated than simply relaxing in the water for at least a half an hour. The thing is, she can touch herself for hours, and it'll do nothing but get her worked up if she's stressed out. Orgasms are a great way to relax, but if she's wound up, she just can't come, no matter how hard she tries. And she's tried. Has she ever tried? It simply doesn't work unless she's already pretty relaxed. Baths are just a very effective means to an end that lets her sleep through the night without being plagued by nightmares, and if she's reacting in a Pavlovian way when she starts to fill the tub, well, there are worse things than having your nipples get hard at the sound of a rushing faucet. Getting off in the bath is efficient, too. She's always been a big fan of efficiency and comfort, and it is comfortable to let her fingers follow slick, wet skin from between her breasts, down her flat stomach, and into the curls between her legs. Comfortable and familiar to trace a fingertip over the nub of her clit and down between the lips of her cunt. She touches herself lazily, in no hurry to get where she's going, teasing herself open, and just barely pressing fingertips into her slit. Sometimes she hooks one leg over the edge of the tub, letting water drip off her toes while she takes advantage of the way she splays open in that position, covering her pussy with one hand, pressing the heel of her palm against her clit as she slides her middle finger into a heat and wetness that is entirely nothing to do with the bath water. Her hips rock a little, enough to set the surface of the water into gentle waves as she works another finger in,
curling them both until she shivers with pleasure. Her free hand wanders. Some nights it's enough to just stroke the insides of her thighs. Sometimes she needs to pinch at tightened nipples, handling herself just this side of roughly. Once in a while, she'll wind that free hand into her own curly hair and pull, gasping as her head tilts back. One thing Astrid never does is think about another person while she's tending to her own needs. Bringing anyone else into the equation just adds stress, no matter how innocuous or unlikely the person is. The problem is that you start thinking about movie stars, and inevitably you end up imagining the people you work with. And Astrid can't afford the distraction of wondering, say, what Peter's steady pianist's hands might feel like on her skin, or how gentle Olivia's touch might be, or how Walter might mangle her name even while he shows nothing but care for her body. No, that way lies only madness, and Astrid has enough madness to deal with already, thank you. So she keeps her mind carefully clear, and thumbs her clit until she feels the swell of climax threatening, and drives her fingers a little deeper, and after she reaches a shivery, sighing orgasm, she leans her head back against the tub and just breathes for a few minutes, giving herself over to complete relaxation, until the water starts to cool. She drains the tub and towels off, pulls on pajamas and brushes her teeth, and when she finally slips into bed, maybe 15 minutes later, she still feels languid and at ease, enough to fall asleep without the pills she resorts to on other nights. She could let her job get to her so much more than she actually does. If she didn't have some way to keep her mind clear at night, she would probably have nightmares or insomnia. Her methods aren't foolproof. Sometimes, what she sees while working with the Fringe Division is just too terrible. But she's certain that her little relaxation rituals help her stay sane. The End. Sleep. By What I Must Write. Fandom. Supernatural. Pairing. Dean Castiel. Sleep. Sleep was always a source of fascination for Castiel, even before he had ventured onto Earth. Angels didn't sleep, and even in their vessels it wasn't necessary. But some still preferred to, because vessels have difficulty surviving without rest. He'd tried it once before, loved the floating feeling that just carried you away from your problems that consumed your reality. It was pleasant enough, although he wasn't overly fond of the hazy curtain that covered his mind in the first few minutes of waking. But even better than sleeping was watching Dean sleep. It had become a routine for him since Dean had been pulled back into the world of Supernatural. With the war in heaven, this was a comfort. If Sam was there, which wasn't very often, he would watch from a distance, hidden in the shadows of the motel room. And when he wasn't, it gave him the opportunity to get closer, to get a better look, to examine every crease and groove and angle of his ruggedly handsome face. During the day, the man was tense and paranoid, weighed down by his expectations of himself and everything he had seen. In his sleep, it was like he was free. He was completely relaxed as he drooled against his pillow. He slept on his stomach, Castiel had found out, with one hand hidden beneath the pillow, whilst the other was bunched up beneath his chin, clutching the duvet in a tight grasp. The sheets fell down the curve of his back, revealing tantalizing and scarred skin to Castiel's greedy eyes, and the outline of his splayed legs were prominent through the fabric. One bare foot peeked out at the end of the bed. Dean was vulnerable. That was what Castiel thought. And it was such a contrast that he wasn't sure. Maybe he wanted to protect him, watch his back when he couldn't do it himself. It seemed like a better reason than he liked to watch him sleep, which he found out was something humans considered creepy. But when he heard Dean's sleep-cracked voice through the heavy silence, all thoughts of excuses an explanation of his presence in the mortal room, completely fled his mind. His mouth was strangely dry, and all he could do was stare through wide eyes, frozen in place at the foot of the bed. Dean was blinking tiredly up at him, a small frown on his face as his brain struggled to catch up with current events. He yawned and rubbed one eye with the back of his hand.
"Cass?"
he said again. "Are you going to stand there all night?"
I could sit down if you prefer,"
Castiel offered nervously, gesturing towards the spare bed that should be taken by Sam. Dean shook his head slightly, as much as he could without sitting up.
"No, Sammy will be back soon."
He shifted backward slightly, clearing a space beside him.
"Join me?"
I'm sorry."
"Cass, don't make a big deal out of it and get into bed," Dean breathed out heavily.
Castiel took a hesitant step forward.
"Close off, Cass," he reminded the angel carefully.
He paused and was overcome with feelings he didn't quite understand, one that made his heart pound against his chest, his stomach churn, and his hands shake when he tugged his trench coat from his body. Dean had his eyes closed again, settling onto his back, and Castiel fumbled with his shoes and, after a moment, his trousers, as he tried to take in as much as he could of the scene before him, as though he couldn't get enough. He awkwardly climbed into the free space, his body tense, arms stiff at his side, and he glanced nervously at the man beside him, who cracked one eye open and chuckled throatily.
"You're supposed to take your tie off," he teased.
When the battle-worn hands, calloused from years of holding weapons, hovered in front of his face, Castiel's breath caught. He watched with wide eyes, barely breathing as they carefully unwound the silk tie, pulling it gently from under his collar and tossing it somewhere beyond the island of the bed. Dean's body was hot against his, enticing a shiver to run through his body, and he licked his lips nervously. Strong arms were thrown across his chest, one leg straddling his waist, his foot encouraging the tense limbs to part slightly, intertwining them. One of his hands slipped beneath the fabric of his button-up shirt to stroke across the unmarred skin, urging the angel's body to relax. Castiel did so with a shaky breath, instinctively leaning into the curve of Dean's body. Dean tiredly nuzzled his face into the crook of Castiel's neck, inhaling the earthy smell, his hands flexing teasingly around his hips. There was a moment of silence where Castiel wasn't sure what he was supposed to do.
"Sleep."
Dean murmured the order against his skin, his breath heating the area, and Castiel's eyes fluttered to obey. Sleep was an intriguing thing, although he never really understood it until then, with Dean's body pressed so tightly against him, their breathing slowly sinking, the warmth, the comfort, the safety of sleep, and more importantly, sleep next to someone you care about, was wonderful and overwhelming and perfect. Castiel's breathing deepened, lips parted, and eyes closed, and finally, he slept. The end. Rain Shadow by Tris B. Fandom Star Trek 2009. Pairing Amanda Grayson, Sarek. Amanda grows in the human city called Seattle, in the lee of the Olympic Mountains. Her father broke faith with his family some time ago. Her mother is of Ashkenazi descent, but she is not observant. Then, none of them were. Amanda has seen her cousins at awkward events, the young girls all in skirts, the married women in wigs to keep their real hair a gift for their bonded ones alone, their husbands and God. Amanda tries to understand the life and the words, but her father says religion is useless. He says, "Now the world is so much bigger than during the age of the book."
There are too many quantifiable things to learn about to spend time dwelling on what can never be understood. Her mother says faith is complicated and blinding. Amanda studies philosophy. In graduate school, she meets a guest speaker at her seminar. He speaks of the Kirshara, vessel of wakeful tidings. He says, "Only one human has ever touched it." He says, "It is my privilege to convey the teachings of Surak to Earth, as it is my privilege to represent all aspects of Vulcan culture to your people." He says, "I can show you." And their first wedding is performed by Amanda's cousin, the rabbi, on the shore of Puget Sound. Amanda lives in the Vulcan city called Shikar, in the lee of the Langan Mountains. In some stretched-out seasons, it feels like nothing so much as a crucible, gravity's ominous pull and the heat of the forge pressing on her from above and below, a law of chemistry her father wouldn't believe she still knows. Long sleeves and stiff fabrics at this point seem like a test, and Amanda returns to her studies, waiting out the discomfort. She is the second human ever to lay hands on the original Kirshara. Sarek sees to that. She thinks he thought that if she read the teachings of Surak on her own, she would agree with all they said. She laughs at this and reminds him how they met. On her wall, she mounts the ketubah that was her aunt's wedding gift. Her parents' signatures bearing shaky witness to the marriage of Amanda and Sarek, illustrated with the painting of two trees whose roots intertwine. She sees her son's struggle to prove himself to Vulcan children and covers her ears in solidarity, finding that wearing a hood for love is no great sacrifice at all. She reads to him books from her childhood, rainy nonsense about boiling seas, and she can only hope he might one day understand. On her terrace, under a strange sun, Amanda tends her garden. The End. Waking Up With You Hiding in My Bones by Quintensi. Fandom, Merlin. Pairing, Merlin Gwaine. Gwaine's been sitting on Merlin's roof for 20 minutes when the window opens and Merlin climbs out, huddled into the hoodie he must have thrown over his pajamas. "Hi," he says, like he finds people outside his bedroom window in the middle of the night all the time. "Hi," Gwaine replies, shuffling over to give Merlin room to sit next to him. "Sorry, I couldn't sleep." "So you thought you'd sit on my roof all night?" Merlin asks around a yawn. He smiles at Gwaine, lopsided and bemused and so sweet. "Yeah," Gwaine says quietly. He hasn't got the energy for a witty retort, for a joke and a laugh and a tease. He's just so tired. "Do you mind?" "Of course I mind," Merlin says, and Gwaine's stomach drops. "It's freezing out here. You'll catch your death." Gwaine exhales, slowly, and follows Merlin into his room. He stumbles, jumping down from the window, and swears softly, mindful of Huneth asleep in the next room. "Here," Merlin says. "You can have my bed, and..." "No," Gwaine says sharply. "Fuck, Merlin, I already..." "I'm not fucking taking your bed. It's not like I'd get any use out of it anyway." He forces himself to smile. "The floor is fine." Merlin looks like he's going to argue, but then he just sighs and makes Gwaine up a bed on the floor, turns around to let him shed his jeans and t-shirt. The blanket is soft and warm and smells a bit like Merlin, and Gwaine lets himself breathe it in for a second. Just one. "Good night," Merlin whispers. "Hope you get some sleep." And Gwaine echoes the sentiment as he lies back, counting Merlin's breaths until he's sure he's asleep. Gwaine must drift off at one point, because he jolts back to awareness at the sound of stifled moaning. At first he thinks maybe Merlin's having a nightmare, but then... Oh. Oh. It's not that kind of moan. It's not that kind of dream. Gawain wonders, momentarily, what it is Merlin's dreaming about to make him make noises like that, and has to fist his hands in the blanket. No. No, he's not going there. Merlin is one of his closest friends, and Gawain can't... Fantasizing about Merlin when he's jerking off, about Merlin's perfect hands and perfect mouth, is bad enough. He can't think about Merlin naked and wanting when Merlin is in the same fucking room as him. That way lies madness, and also failed friendships. He rolls over and jams his head under Merlin's pillow, willing the blood to rush back to his brain where he needs it, and closes his eyes. He's awoken a few hours later by the sun streaming in through the window. They forgot to close the curtains after they climbed in, damn it. And he is hard. Like, achingly hard. Like, you were having a really fantastic dream before you were rudely awoken hard. Gawain groans, wondering if he was dreaming about Merlin, and if that would be ironic or just pathetic. A quick glance at the bed shows Merlin still asleep, the jammy bastard, and Gawain's hand is in his boxers before he can think about it. He bites his lip, hard, and thinks about getting Merlin to make those noises again, about panting into Merlin's neck as he jerks him off, about sinking to his knees and taking Merlin's cock into his mouth, about fingering Merlin open until he's begging for it, and comes. The end. Stands For by Jane David. Fandom Suits. Pairing Mike Ross, Harvey Specter. V is for the victory dance Mike does around Harvey's office, drunk with triumph at landing a client. That just makes Harvey plan ways to use all that energy more productively. Later. In bed. With Mike naked. And, yes, he can still wiggle his ass just like that, if he likes. A is for that ass. L is for late. Harvey, not Mike. But he was jerking off thinking about Mike, so really, it's all Mike's fault, and the stack of filing he gives him as a reprimand is well earned. E is for envy. Mike's so fucking good at what he does, and he's only just begun his rise. Not that Harvey's ever minded competition, but with Mike, well, his hands are tied. Not literally. Those would be Mike's hands. To the shower head, the headboard, the hook on the wall. N is for never, ever, not ever again, is he going to suck Mike off in the men's room when anyone could walk in. Well, never's a long time. T is for Tuesday. Today's Monday. It's Mike's day off. Monday seems to be lasting a long time. I is for intent, and his are pure. He swears it even as he makes Mike beg and mule, so fucking pretty, flush-faced, wide-eyed. His. N is for nights spent sleeping next to Mike. Harvey always aware that he's sharing a bed with someone dangerous, to his career, his reputation, his heart. Mike doesn't know just how dangerous he is. Harvey hopes he never does. E is for expectations. Harvey's are high. Too high to meet sometimes. But it's fun to watch Mike jump. The end. Reader's notes. So, last year, about 4 days before Valentine's Day, I made a very sudden decision to record an anthology of awesome short fics for those of us that need a pick-me-up mid-February but don't really do Valentine's Day. It was a really fun and rewarding project to record such a huge variety of tiny fics, which I think often get overlooked in favor of longer fics and podfics. You would think that I would have been better organized and planned in advance this year, but once again, about a week before February 14th, I thought I would make a new anthology filled with new ficlets. And I'm really glad I did. This round was just as fun to put together as last year, and just as interesting to dabble in a whole lot of different fandoms and a whole bunch of different genres, many of which I don't often delve into. All the fics this year came from authors who have blanket permission to record, which is always amazing and wonderful when you're trying to put something together like this fairly quickly because you didn't plan ahead. Huge, huge thanks to all of them for permission to record. Please go back and leave them lots of love on their fics. You can find them all linked on the Podfic post wherever you downloaded these. All of the authors in alphabetical order are Alchemy Alice, Aris Merquoni, Astolat, Book Addict 43, Bright Wolf, Kathleen, Dancin' Butterfly, Elmira Emily, Green, Hardboiled Baby, Jane David, Crystal Ice Kitsu, Night Reveals, Quintency, Specky Geek Girl, Triss B, What I Must Write, and Wow Bright. And that's it. I hope everybody has a wonderful mid-February, and thanks for listening.